Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. Good to have you all with us. You're about to listen to Soundbites, our weekly look at food, farming, and our environment. You're listening to Soundbites here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community out of Baltimore, Maryland, and on Delmarva Public Radio, WSDL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM throughout the Eastern Shore, Delaware, and Virginia. And we are joined here by Michael McDermott, who is a Republican member of the Maryland House of Delegates, representing District 38B, Wicomico and Worcester Counties, and Scott Edwards, co-director of Food and Water Watch Justice Project at Food and Water Watch, as we look at this issue that will be developing in a big way, I think, during the Maryland State Legislative Session. It's going to be called the Poultry Fair Share Act. And this act, proposed legislation, would require companies like Perdue and Tyson to pay a fee per head on all the chickens they own being raised by farmers they contract with in the state of Maryland. And advocates say that our large agribusinesses are not paying their fair share of keeping the bay healthy, that it falls on the back of farmers and other citizens. Others are saying, though, that this is just another tax on Maryland businesses, unneeded, drive out of business that we need in the state of Maryland, and that Perdue alone has spent over $45 million to address chicken litter issues on the shore. It's quite a controversial issue, an important one for us to wrestle with that we will be doing over the course of the next months as we lead up to the session in Annapolis and raising this at our Annapolis Summit, which begins on January 8th that morning with the governor. And let me welcome both Delegate Michael McDermott and Scott Edwards to the program. Good to have you both with us on Soundbites.
Hey, thanks, Mark. I'm glad to join you.
Well, and thank you, Mark. Good morning.
Good morning, Scott. So, Scott, let me start with you since the organization you're with is kind of, as I said, at the head of this conversation proposing this issue. A number of state legislators I've talked to are talking about introducing this bill. Why this bill? Why do you feel it's necessary?
Well, I think we all recognize that the bay is in trouble. It's suffering from nutrient pollution. We know that agriculture plays a large role throughout the Bay watershed and in the state of Maryland in phosphorus and nitrogen loads into the Bay. And over the several last years, we've seen a big effort in the state of Maryland to try to fund ways to clean up the Bay. And everybody is being asked to do something to help out. We have the Bay Restoration Fund, which places $60 a year on households who use wastewater treatment facilities to upgrade those facilities so they reduce their loads to the Bay. We have septic users throughout the state also paying $60 per year into a fund, and only 60% of that goes to septic upgrades, 40% of that, and that's a $27 million fund, so about 40% of that. Somewhere around $11 million of that doesn't even go into septics. It goes into agricultural cost share programs. We have significant Maryland Department of Ag programs that fund agriculture to try to clean up through the MAX program, through the cost share program, through manure storage sheds, through cover crops. So you've got a massive amount of effort being put in to try to restore the bay. And the one industry that's really contributing significantly is not being asked to put anything into this. So we think the Poultry Fair Share Act is a very equitable, fair, reasonable request that the companies who derive a tremendous amount of economic benefit, the Perdues, the Harims, the Mount Airs, from operating in the Bay watershed, that they contribute something in the same way that everybody else is being asked to contribute. And so our hope is that through this act, we can generate enough money so that the septic portion of the money that now goes to cover crops, 100% of that septic money can go to septics, and these big companies can cover the portion of that septic money that goes to cover crops. That's 40% of the $27 million.
Michael McDermott, what happens if this bill is introduced, and your thoughts on it?
Well, you know, ultimately, when this is nothing new, honestly, on the liberal agenda plate that comes into the General Assembly, you can go back and look in the 90s and see stuff from the mid-90s to the late 90s, people trying to approach poultry and agriculture in particular with some type of a punitive whip in order to generate some other type of industrial tax in order to basically redefine an industry and making up, honestly, making up a lot of these issues as we go along and spouting out these numbers that are widely disputed. When it comes time to really look at the science involved, we're not spending a lot of time on that. We're spending a lot of time on trying to punish a particular, I know the Food and Water Watch folks have labeled this not the Poultry Fair Share Act, but the Purdue Fair Share Act. And, you know, it's ironic because we have reduced on the Eastern Shore in particular, in Maryland, the poultry industry has been taking it on the chin now for the last 10 years. And in the last 5 years, we've literally had a moratorium on even building new houses. As an industry, which is a huge part of Maryland's financial well-being, which is agriculture, and poultry being the number one agriculture portion of that particular segment, when you take that away or you look at a way to punitively attack a business, whether it's through taxes or overregulation, in a state that's already suffering lost revenue because businesses are leaving, this is not the pathway to success. You talk about a business that has invested in the community, that has brought multiplied millions, hundreds of millions of dollars into our local economy as well as into the state coffers. You can't approach it from this aspect as if somehow if we create a tax on big poultry and it applies really only to one or two companies, that somehow that's going to make a big difference in the long haul if you're going to shut down an entire industry or create just another reason why a business should leave Maryland and not do business here. That's not good economics. It doesn't make sense in a state that's already half a billion in a revenue shortfall to go ahead and try and find a way to attack another industry. We need these companies, and we need them to be successful. And there are other ways to go about solving the problems with the Bay rather than looking at business saying, well, this is the magic bullet. Somehow, if we can just get Purdue or Tyson or Harem to pay a little bit more money, we'll be okay. I would challenge Scott and say, look, the first thing that he should be trying to do is keeping the General Assembly's hands out of the Chesapeake Bay Restoration Fund money. I mean, when I sit up there as a Republican and have to introduce legislation to protect $20 million in that fund, and because it's supposed to be a trust, and I'm sitting up there trying to put in amendments to keep the money in there, and those same people that are going to be introducing legislation to make Purdue pay more money are taking that money out to cover holes in the general fund, you tell me who's got a better idea of what's going on with the Bay.
Scott?
Yeah, you know, I find it ironic that somebody would label this as a liberal agenda when the entire corporate agricultural structure and all the cost share and all the max money, all the cover crop is a giant corporate welfare program where the taxpayers of Maryland are the ones who are now footing the bill to try to keep an industry from polluting. You know, I've heard Delegate McDermott in op-eds talk about how agriculture in Maryland is doing its share. They're meeting all of their milestones. They're doing what's needed to be done. What's not talked about, though, is those milestones. If you go back to the Maryland Department of Ag 2012 max funding report, every single one of those milestones is paid for through taxpayers' dollars. $25.5 million of corporate welfare paid out of the pockets of hardworking Maryland families to fund every single one of those milestones. Ag's not meeting its milestones. The taxpayers of Maryland are meeting Ag's milestones for them. And so again, I don't see this as a liberal conservative agenda or issue, but since the delegate brought up this as being a liberal idea, I can't imagine anything less conservative than to continue the road we're going with industrial agriculture in the state of Maryland, which is built entirely on corporate welfare, entirely on state and federal dollars, going to allow companies like Purdue, Perim, and the rest of their four integrators working in Maryland to externalize the cost of their production and to put off the cost of proper waste disposal. This is not bad for the economy by filling gaps. And there's no claim by us or anybody else that putting a 5-cent tax on these big poultry companies to help offset some of the pollution that's going to the bay is a magic bullet or is the fix that's needed. I think it's very clear that in order to meet bay water quality, there's going to be a lot more money that's going to need to be generated. This is just helping out with the septic system. This isn't doing anything more than shifting the septic money where it needs to go and let these companies pitch in and help for the cover crop program.
Well, there's a lot of questions been raised here, but let me go first so we can parse some of this stuff out. And, Michael, let me start with you about parsing some of this out. When Scott Edwards talks about a $25.5 million corporate welfare program that's allow these kind of changes to take place with agriculture, I really want to just take for us to take the next few minutes between the two of you to parse this out so we understand it. What's your perspective?
Well, like Scott talks about money going into the let's talk about the agri-recycle operation where, you know, basically because so much has been made about poultry litter, you've got companies like Purdue that are trying to do their part and find other alternative means and use for poultry litter down here on the shore. Well, the state paid like $1.8 million into that particular resource as a basically a grant, a stimulator to say, hey, you know, we're going to partner with you. We realize this is something that we're interested in seeing. And that's not unusual for the state of Maryland to invest in different types of areas as far as capitalism and trying to spur growth or development. I mean, we do it in Montgomery County with a lot of the corporations over there. There's a lot of investment in the state money. But $1.8 million into this particular operation that Purdue itself has invested $50 million into the same thing. So, you know, when you start talking about, you know, where's the state's money invested in this, it's a small portion of what the corporate side of the house is actually putting out to try and find a way to satisfy the folks that are, you know, that are basically making an uproar about these things for the Maryland side of the Bay Restoration Project when we're not dealing with some of the real issues that are creating the problems in the Bay in the first place. But agriculture doesn't have the strong enough lobby, if you will. They're not populating the areas of the state where, you know, the bulk of the votes come from. And so they're an easy target to pick on when you want to look at it. And, you know, when Scott talks about the cover crops, well, you know, the cover crop demand, that right now we're at 130% compliance as far as our reaching our nutrient management goals when it comes to agriculture in the state of Maryland. We're not at 100%. We're at 130%. We're going way beyond what has even been required or what the timetables are. But it's never enough. It's like you cannot satisfy this other side of the house that demands, you know, these compliances and will not take things on a scale that corporately can be resolved a lot easier when you start talking about trying to absorb these great costs associated with, you know, having, you know, being the one that's labeled responsible, you know, for something that's shared by every citizen of Maryland that's putting anything in the bay. And it's not agriculture. It's simply just not poultry. And I'd like to know, you know, they always talk about these big corporate numbers as if this is this kind of money that's going in when, in fact, you know, these industries themselves, the farmers, the folks that live on the land, all these people are paying all these fees that Scott talks about as well. So I'm not exactly sure that's necessarily the strongest argument that he can make.
So I'm trying to hear kind of hear our listeners kind of trying to parse through all of this and to figure out just where we'd be going with this legislation, Scott, because it's a very confusing issue, because both of you lay out very strong ideas about where the facts of the situation are. People argue about who owns the chickens, who should pay for the chickens, where the litter goes. Purdue has said that they, you know, put out $25 million on their own, just in kind of trying to resolve the question of litter. And so I guess people listening to this might be saying to Scott Edwards and the legislators who might introduce this legislation, what is it do we expect companies like Purdue to do they're not doing?
Let me talk about the manure transport program for a second, since that was raised an issue. I can't think of another industry in the state that has a similar program. Mike says that you know there's lots of money being shifted to industries throughout the state to help deal with problems, and that may be so. But think about what's happening with manure transport program here. Purdue, from the years 2009 to 2012, got $1.8 million of taxpayers' money to go out to farms and pick up its own chicken waste and bring it to a facility that they built, a for-profit facility, to feed that facility the manure that they need to make pellets to then sell for profit. Now, I would challenge anybody to name another industry that's being paid state taxpayers' dollars to go pick up their own waste and bring it to a facility to turn into a profit-making business. I don't think that's replicated anywhere. And I don't know how much money Purdue put. I hear lots of different numbers about how much Purdue has put into their pelletization program. But it's their for-profit company. And I don't understand the argument that we should be applauding and funding Purdue and giving them taxpayers' money to go pick up their own waste and bring it to their facility to make another profit on it. It just doesn't make any sense. That's another indication of a system that needs to be revamped, that we need to look at this system very carefully and to see if this is really what's best for the people of Maryland when we keep funding these kinds of programs. Or do we ask these companies to make some minor sacrifices? Again, Purdue had sales of $4.8 billion in 2010 from their business. We're not asking a lot for them to contribute, and this is not the Purdue Fair Share Act. This is the poultry company. Purdue happens to own a lion's share of the business in the state of Maryland. So this is not such an outrageous demand that we're asking here, that these companies step up and help out. They have derived a significant amount of benefit from operating in this state. Significant.
Mark, do you know, is there a company in Montgomery County that had a moratorium put on their business that lasted 2 years where they couldn't expand, they couldn't grow, they couldn't do anything, they couldn't plan on what their operation was going to look like down the road? Because something that they were doing had to be so regulated by the state of Maryland, and the state couldn't even get their act together enough to approve their company from expanding or building or maintaining their market share. The people in Montgomery County whose jobs were dependent upon that corporation, that company, let's say it was Lockheed or somebody like that, they would be up in arms and outraged that the state of Maryland was creating a regulatory environment that was so punitive that people couldn't even count on their jobs down the road. Well, that's exactly what happened down here on the Eastern Shore under the O'Malley administration because of these regulations. And, you know, we don't want to gloss over this, but things like the nutrient management, the watershed improvement plans that were required, all the CAFO operation permits, none of this stuff was a reality, you know, 15 years ago. All of this has been put on this side of the house, the agricultural side of the house, in the last 10 years. And those types of regulatory crushers, if you will, they actually came and said, look, we've got companies down here dependent upon their market share being maintained. And that means new houses being constructed to replace old ones just to maintain your market share. And as those new houses got stymied, because the administration would not approve, the Department of the Environment would not sign off on permits, the Department of Ag was hamstrung and behaving more like the Department of the Environment, we wound up with 18 months of zero growth when it comes to poultry operations in Maryland, while Delaware itself was expanding at a rapid rate. Now, we lost market share, and you can't have companies and industries in this state that are basically stymied for 18 to 24 months and can't grow, can't move, can't replace because of a permitting process like this, and you keep adding on to that, you are going to eventually put that straw on that camel's back, and it's going to break. And then the same folks that did it are going to step back and look at it and say, geez, I wonder why that happened. Well, this is an important industry. This isn't a small part of our economy. This is the number one important, economically speaking, to Maryland. The number one industry in Maryland is agriculture. It is a farmer and a fisherman that hold up the seal of Maryland. And that farmer, his hand's getting awfully tired holding up the whole state of Maryland and supporting these economic regulations when these things come on them and they have to absorb it. Chicken houses now cost about $50,000 to $75,000 more to build, not because the construction costs have gone up so much, but just to comply with the regulatory environment that we've created. And you reach a point where it doesn't make any sense to do these things in Maryland. And we're trying to protect this industry. And here we go again, you know, just when we think we're trying to work out the phosphorus management tool, we're getting hammered by the Department of Ag and the Department of the Environment. All of these types of regulatory environments coming out of science that is questionable at best. On its best day, it's questionable. And then this is the great idea, is let's go ahead and put another tax on poultry. This is the kind of thing that dries up an entire industry, and they simply move. Now, maybe for Scott, that would be okay if poultry dried up and moved away. But, you know, the first thing that would happen in Maryland is an economic crisis. It would start on the eastern shore, and it would ripple through the state's economy. And then you wouldn't be looking at a $500 million deficit. You'd be looking at deficits in the $1.5 billion kind of money. That's a significant impact on our local economy.
And Scott, I want to have a chance for you to respond because a lot was just said.
Trying to figure out where to begin. Agriculture, not only in Maryland, but throughout the country, is the least regulated industry there is. They get to do things that no other industry do. For example, every other industry in the country, you talk about these poultry facilities, these CAFOs, country animal feeding operations, they are point sources under the Clean Water Act, like wastewater treatment plants, like coal-fired power plants. CAFOs are the only operation that doesn't have to sample their water, make sure they're not polluting, make sure they're not discharging pollutants. They file NMPs, which are paper compliance. I've seen these NMPs. You talk about facilities down the Eastern Shore that are growing 450,000 birds at one time who don't even have land to apply manure. They have an NMP that's 3 or 4 pages long. They say, we're going to ship all of our manure off to some other place, and it gets stamped and filed with the agency. There's not over-regulation of this industry. If anything, there's under-regulation of this industry. And regulation is not punitive, as Mike labeled it. Regulation is protective. It is protective of communities. It's protective of the Bay. There's nothing wrong with regulation. Regulations are what have turned our waterways around the last 40 years when 4 decades ago they were on flames. They were so filled with pollutants that no one could swim or drink in them. If we want our waterways to look like they do in developing nations where you can't even use them, then we can get rid of regulations like they don't have regulations overseas, and we can live with polluted waterways. I don't think that's what the American people want. We should be regulating this industry. It's not punitive. It's protective. There were several other issues that Mike raised in terms of moratorium. Name another industry, the fracking industry. Okay, in Maryland, you can't go and frack yet because the jury's still out on whether fracking can be done safely. In some people's minds, we're convinced that fracking can't be done safely. So there are lots of industries that need to be regulated properly and that you put an end to them until you can figure out how to do so. Agriculture is not alone in that respect. In terms of economic impacts, I keep hearing from folks that agriculture is the number one economic engine of the state of Maryland, and I'm not sure where they're getting that from. If you go to the Maryland state-owned economic development website, you will see that agriculture doesn't even show up on the list of top-generating businesses in the state of Maryland. These are official statistics that are gathered by the state. If you look at GDP generation in the state, you will see that agriculture combined with mining and forestry, those three together only account for 0.2% of the state's GDP. Now, I'm not saying agriculture is not important, but the notion that it is the number one economic driver of this state is absolutely false. And what needs to happen down the Eastern Shore is not that you get rid of agriculture, not that you get rid of farming. What you need to do is you need to transform the industry down the Eastern Shore to return to farming. Because what's happening there now isn't farming, it's monoculture.
So,
it's a single crop, it's chickens.
Well, I have to interrupt you. We have to take a break here, but this is a very important subject. I think both of you outlined pretty intensely the different sides of this. This is just our first look at this. We're going to be devoting whole hours and conversations to this coming up and through the state legislature, and we'll be raising it again on June the 8th at our Annapolis Summit with the governor, the president, and the speaker of the House, and through the legislative session here on Soundbites as we look. This is a very quickly, we want to lay this out for you to understand what's going on so you can hear the positions on different sides of this issue. Michael McDermott, who is a Republican member of the House of Delegates from Wicomico and Worcester Counties, that's District 38B. Michael, good to have you with us. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Mark.
And Scott Edwards, co-director of Food and Water Watch Justice Project at Food and Water Watch. Scott, welcome. Thank you for being with us as well.
Thanks for having me on, Mark. Appreciate it.
And we will really continue to cover this. This goes to the heart of the discussions we'll be having here, I think, in the state of Maryland, at least on this issue, in the coming months. And this is just our first bite at that apple. And thank you all so much for joining us here. We're going to take a brief break here on the Mark Steiner Show and Sound Bites. We are going to look at nicotinoids, and what they have to do with the future of bees in this country. And then I talked to Sandra Katz about fermentation. It's more than beer and more than sauerkraut. Stay with us. We'll be right back on Soundbites. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and welcome back to the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites, our weekly look at food farming and our farming system and the environment here. You're listening to Soundbites here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community out of Baltimore, Maryland, and on Marvel Public Radio, WSDL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM on the shore. And we continue our conversation here looking at these issues, and we're right now about to have a conversation with Jay Feldman, who is co-founder and executive director of Beyond Pesticides. We're reflecting on an ad that was taken out in the New York Times yesterday with all these signatories calling for the Environmental Protection Agency to impose a moratorium on neonicotinoids. There's a bill being introduced in the House called Saving America's Pollinators. That's House Bill H.R. 2692, and it has to do with saving the bees. We've talked about before in the show, and Jay, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
So talk a bit about what this is. This push, this call for this national ad in the New York Times. Tell us what's going on.
Well, you know, we have been experiencing in this country a phenomenon that some refer to as colony collapse disorder, where essentially bees are not returning to the hives. They get disoriented as they're going out and foraging and pollinating, and the declining health of bees really has been associated with a number of factors. Significant among them are these neonicotinoids you mentioned, which are a family of pesticides that are systemic in the plant. So in other words, they're treated on the seed principally. There are other applications, but principally treated on the seed, they then get incorporated into the vascular system of the plant, and then they're expressed through the pollen and the nectar and the gutation, those little droplets on the plant. So when the bees go out, they're basically going out in a poison field. And as a result, they are becoming poisoned and disoriented and unable to return to the hives.
I saw a study once that said that at least 40% of all the items you pick off a shelf in the grocery store would no longer be there if we didn't have the pollination of bees.
That's right. I mean, a lot of our vegetable crops require this. We'd have a diet of grains. Basically, we'd be left with Some estimates are a third of what we eat. One in every three bites of food are, you know, require pollination. And, of course, all the flowers that we see that require pollination as well. So, you know, it's, in terms of survival of the planet, sustainability, protection of beneficial organisms, the interrelationship between nature and humans, the management of our agriculture and the way in which we grow food. I mean, all of this is wrapped up in this question of how do we regulate pesticides? You know, how do we make decisions that take into account the full range of potential adverse effects on the environment? Now, you know, this ad came out, and the timing was very important because it came out at the same time that the European Union decided to remove these materials from the environment. They've established a 2-year moratorium, and basically they looked at the scientific data, the independent peer-reviewed science that shows that these chemicals are not only systemic, but they're persistent in the environment, and now they're being found in waterways as well. So, you know, we have this sort of growing problem, the dimensions of which really haven't really been fully appreciated yet by the regulatory process. We have the European Union acting throughout the European nations to withdraw these chemicals from the market. And we have EPA sitting around just debating and throwing out dates like, well, we'll complete a review out in 5 years in 2018, and that's how we're going to do it.
So let me ask you two quick questions here. I mean, clearly you're saying the science is there. I'm curious how big an industry we're talking about is our neonicotinoids when it comes to the what we know about the size of it in terms of money, in terms of jobs and everything else, and how that affects us, the argument, and why you think it's taking so long for America to want to address this. How does it really affect us?
Yeah. Well, you know, we have a history of badly regulating pesticides, inadequate registration, obviously, as most listeners, most of your listeners know, you know, these laws are subject to political wrangling in Congress, and so they ultimately are compromised pieces of legislation. And then once adopted, you know, when you give an agency discretion, you give authority to lobbyists to go in there and twist arms. Yes, of course, the economic impact is always an argument the industry uses. We're talking about billions of dollars worth of crops. We're also talking about $20 to $30 billion worth of lost crops associated with lost pollination. So, you know, you have to figure that's an economic cost as well. And we, at Beyond Pesticides, of course, we advance organic production as an alternative. And in every commodity group that we're talking about that is treated with these neonicotinoids, there are organic production alternatives. So it's not as if you can make an essentiality claim that we can't live without these chemicals. But, of course, those who produce the chemicals have influence over the laws that are written, influence the implementation of those laws through the regulatory agencies. And as a result, we end up in this quagmire where everyone is, you know, playing this game of chess and holding each other at bay. The regulators know that the science is out there. They feel hamstrung. The industry makes the economic argument and the claim, despite the availability of alternative crop production systems that do not rely on these chemicals. And you get into this clear, you know, situation where there is simply no action taken. Now, EPA did act, we have to say this, did act on a portion of the problem, which is this what they call fugitive dust that comes off the planters when they plant corn. And so the dust that comes off these planters is basically contaminating all plant life around the fields, many of which is pollinated or at least foraged by the bees. So EPA has tightened up somewhat the labels on these products, but beekeepers say, you know, from a scientific perspective, really doesn't matter much if you control that dust if the actual chemical is in the pollen, you know, and in the nectar, as these bees both pollinate. And key to this whole thing is foraging. You know, we think, well, corn's not pollinated by bees, so why do you care if the plant's poisoned? Well, bees forage in these fields, even though they're not pollinating the crop. So it's, you know, these are really important questions that have been held back, not, you know, by the regulatory and the system and the politics. And the science is certainly there, but, you know, the politics has not caught up with the science.
So very quickly, Jay, give a website where people can get more information.
Well, you can go to our website, beyondpesticides.org. You can also go to save-bees.org. And at that site, we're hoping that people will sign on and send, you know, click the button and send a letter to Administrator of EPA Gina McCarthy and let her know that, you know, action is way overdue. We've got to act now.
And we will come back to this on H.R. 2692 on the neonicotinoids and ban them in the United States in a debate format coming up soon. We just want to lay this out. We just read in the New York Times yesterday. Jay Feldman, co-founder and executive director of Beyond Pesticides, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we'll have all that information on our website. We are take a quick musical break, come back here in seconds to talk with Sandra Katz about fermentation. Welcome back to the Mark Steiner Show here and Soundbites. We are about to have a conversation with Sandra Alex Katz, who wrote the books Wild Fermentation, The Revolution Will Not Be Microwaved, most recently The Art of Fermentation, and was featured in this most recent issue of Yes Magazine, one of our partners, Fermentation Fervor, and a conversation with Sandra Katz. And Sandra, welcome back. Good to have you with us here on Mark Steiner and Soundbites.
Thanks for having me on the show again.
So, yes, fermentation, a lot more than sauerkraut and beer.
Sure, yeah, it's a lot more, but those things aren't a bad place to start.
Well, you started with sauerkraut.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that that's, you know, that's the fermentation process that is most straightforward, that I recommend for almost anyone as an introductory fermentation experience. You don't need any special equipment. You don't need starter cultures. It is extremely safe. You can see results pretty quickly. It's incredibly delicious and supportive of good health.
So let me just take a step back for a moment with you, and let's just talk about what this really means. I mean, because fermentation, as you write about, is that this ancient process of how we preserved our foods, one of the ways we preserved our foods before we had refrigeration. So it really is kind of looking at, some people see it as so primitive with refrigerators, why do we even need it? If you could.
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, that's an awfully limited perspective. I mean, even today in 2013, most of the people on planet Earth do not have a refrigerator in their home. And, you know, given the amount of uncertainty and anxiety about energy futures, there's no guarantee that we'll always have access to adequate supplies of cheap energy for everyone to maintain a fermentation slowing device in their home.
So, but you also talk about the fermentation and probiotics in this piece that was that I saw in Yes Magazine, which I think is really important because we look at bacteria as and dirt as our enemy, right?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, for any of us who were raised in the United States in the second half of the 20th century, we were thoroughly indoctrinated with the idea that bacteria are our enemies. Bacteria are to be avoided. Bacteria are to be eradicated. You know, they're nothing but a nuisance. And I think that we've really, you know, really thanks more than anything to new methods in biology, we're rounding out our picture and developing a more nuanced appreciation of bacteria. And, you know, the emerging consensus in evolutionary biology is that all life is descended from bacteria. And the corollary to that is that no form of life has ever lived without bacteria. And, you know, we are utterly dependent on bacteria that are in our bodies and which, in fact, outnumber our bodily cells by something like 10 to 1. And similarly, you know, a carrot and an insect and, you know, any form of life is dependent on the bacteria that it associates with and really from which it is descended.
And the process, so talk a bit about this, this process of fermentation and I mean, how that, I mean, you know, when you eat sauerkraut at Thanksgiving, which is what most people do, but we don't think about what goes into the process and also what the process builds inside the food. So I'm saying, I mean,
well,
that's,
I mean, so first of all, I mean, fermentation is a natural process. You know, for a biologist, what fermentation means is anaerobic metabolism, the production of energy without oxygen. And so, you know, fermentation happens without human intervention, and, you know, microbial change to our food is pretty much inevitable. And so, you know, all around the world, as agricultural practices emerged, you know, people had to, you know, figure out ways to sort of harness this inevitable process of microbial change and find ways to use it to make foods more delicious, more digestible, or more stable for long-term storage or transportation, rather than just having microbial decomposition, you know, rot the food into a mess that nobody would want to eat. So you know, really fermentation processes have been a matter of survival historically all around the world, you know, and the legacy of these processes is found in culinary traditions everywhere. And if you walk into a gourmet food store and look around and think about the nature of the foods that we elevate on this pedestal, almost all of them are products of fermentation. The highest expression of most culinary traditions around the world is embodied in products of fermentation.
Like what?
Cheese, wine, cured meats, condiments, chocolate, coffee. I mean, many, many foods that people, you know, don't necessarily associate with fermentation rely upon fermentation.
And what you're also, though, advocating and talk a lot about is how we put that into our daily lives, what we can do with it at home.
Yeah, sure. Well, I would say that, you know, most people listening to your show, whether they're thinking about it or not, you know, are eating fermented foods in the course of every day. You know, bread is fermented, cheese is fermented, coffee is fermented. I mean, right there you have, you know, components of a typical American breakfast. So you know, whether they're thinking about it or not, people are eating products of fermentation. Now, there is a subset of fermented foods which are not heated after their fermentation, which have their live bacterial cultures intact, and these live culture foods are really the ones that that have probiotic potential, and that, you know, ingesting them in uncooked forms, you know, can really help to replenish and diversify microbial populations. And, you know, I mean, until the last couple of generations, nobody really ever had to think about replenishing or diversifying bacteria in the gut, because there was nothing in our lives that was compromising it. But, you know, with the emergence of antibiotic drugs and their overuse in animal populations as well as human populations, you know, with the widespread use of antibacterial cleansing products, with the nearly universal use of chlorine to kill bacteria in our water, we have chemical exposure every day that compromises the bacteria that we rely on in our gut. So it's just become much more important in our historical moment than ever before for people to consciously replenish these populations with foods that are rich in live bacterial cultures.
And you were also writing about how much of what we eat that's fermented also has this kind of health benefits in terms of medicine. There's some very natural stuff that comes out that are anti-carcinogenic that you write about, and other things that that really kind of benefit us that we don't even think about when it comes to fermented foods.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. There are unique micronutrients that are metabolic byproducts of specific bacteria that are found in different fermented foods, some of which have extraordinary benefit for us. And then beyond that, there's simply the improved bioavailability of nutrients in our food. Fermentation really amounts to predigestion. So, you know, lots of dense compound nutrients that can be difficult for our bodies to access in our food become much more bioavailable to us as a result of the predigestion of fermentation.
So talking about, let me just get this one part here. So I know that you're interested in sharing this with us. I'm interested in it. During the fall, one of my favorite things to make is what I call a root stew. You know, I like putting together every imaginable root that you can think of, plopping it into a pot and making it with a good vegetable stock and creating this incredible root stew that all can eat, and vegetarians and everybody else and vegans, and just enjoy, as well as carnivores who want to change of pace. And you have, I understand, a recipe for fermenting root vegetables.
Yeah, root vegetables ferment really nicely. I mean, let me just say more broadly than fermentation. I mean, you know, root vegetables are a miracle. And, you know, at this time of year and most of the climates of the United States, root vegetables are abundant. And I've been, you know, really trying to make use of all of the radishes and turnips coming out of my garden and being gifted to me by other friends with gardens. And, you know, certainly stewing them, roasting them. I make pancakes with them, but I also love to ferment them. And I don't have a straightforward recipe to offer.
That's
but
right.
You can use any combination of root vegetables or any single root vegetable. Radishes of various description. I love the big black Spanish radishes. I love the watermelon radishes. I love big daikon radishes, but any kind of radishes, any kind of turnips, and turnips also just come in this extraordinary, dazzling array of colors. Rutabaga, carrots, beets, you know, there's really no root vegetable that you couldn't ferment either together with leafy greens or solo. And what you want to do is expose surface area, you know, on some or most or even all of the root vegetables. This could be grating and making them into very small pieces with a huge amount of surface area. This could be slicing them in different kinds of ways. You know, this really is the realm of creative expression and how you choose to chop up the vegetables. But what you're trying to do is expose surface area. Then lightly salt. You don't need to sort of be meticulous about this. You don't need to measure a certain amount of salt. I mean, this is really like any other recipe that says salt to taste. So lightly salt them, then mix everything up and salt, and then add more salt if you want to. It's always easier to add salt than it is to subtract salt. The simplest vessel to use would be a jar. A 1-quart jar, wide mouth jars are the easiest to work with. A 1-quart jar will fit about 2 pounds of vegetables. A gallon size jar will take about 8 pounds of vegetables to fill. The 55-gallon barrel that I recently filled took about 450 pounds of vegetables
wow.
to fill. So you shred your vegetables, lightly salt. If you want, you can leave some of the vegetables whole. I love to bury some whole vegetables in amongst the chopped up vegetables. But the point of chopping the vegetables is to pull water out of the vegetables, and the salt helps with that process. But then if you get in there with your clean hands and squeeze a little bit, or else take some blunt instrument and pound a little bit, what you'll be doing is breaking down cell walls and basically enabling the cells to give up their juices so you can get the vegetables submerged under their juices. Once the vegetables are nice and juicy, you just stuff them into a jar with some force so the vegetables are submerged under their liquid. I like to put the lids on loosely and just leave them on the kitchen counter. And then every morning just press down on the surface and make sure they get submerged. If you do this in a larger kind of a vessel like a crock, I generally like to leave a weight bearing down, pressing the vegetables and keeping them under the brine all the time.
So very quickly,
time is highly variable. You could ferment it for 3 or 4 days, 3 or 4 weeks, or even if you had a cellar that's not heated, 3 or 4 months. What I like to recommend that people do is just taste it at regular intervals and get a sense of the spectrum of flavors. And if you ever taste it and feel like you don't want it to get any more sour, then move it into your fermentation slowing device, put it into the fridge, and that will just slow it down to an imperceptible rate.
So, and I'm just curious, you know, I know what sauerkraut tastes like. So, I mean, all fermented vegetables, when you do this, do they all taste similar? They have very distinct flavors.
Well, I mean, they all, what they have in common is the flavor of lactic acid. But whatever, you know, every kind of vegetable is also unique in its flavors and its textures. So, you know, if you ferment, daikon radishes alone, that has a very different taste than if you ferment turnips alone, even though they might look identical. So, you know, each vegetable has its own unique flavor. And then they'll all be, enhanced by the wonderful flavor of lactic acid.
Well, this is always great to talk to you. Sandra Alex Katz, of course, one of our nation's leading experts on fermentation. He's known as a fermentation revivalist. Wrote books like Wild Fermentation, The Revolution Will Not Be Microwaved, and The Art of Fermentation. His writing and his books will all be linked to on our website here. And Sandra, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Always a pleasure. I want to thank all of you for listening to the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites here on the radio here on Delmarva Public Radio, 90.7 FM WSDL and 89.5 WSCL, of course, WEAA 88.9 FM. And the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites are productions of the Center for Emerging Media, made possible in part by the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Mark Henry and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer WEAA is Andre Melton. Our engineer at Public Radio Delmarva is Christopher Rank. To hear this show again, podcast our past shows, find out information about our guests and the work they do, and link to the discussions we've been having, please go to steinershow.org, steinershow.org. You can also listen to and download all of our podcasts now on iTunes. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and WSDL 90.7 FM, and WSCL 89.5 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.